What's up, Harvard lawyers? Welcome to the Jesus and Movies podcast, where we search movies for lines, scenes, characters, and themes that trace truth and the gospel. I'm Kevin Carlock. I'm here with my fellow U.S. Marine Corps supporter, Graham Hooten, and our hope is that you'll join us on the great journey of storytelling by asking thoughtful questions about why certain movies and moments resonate or don't resonate, and what that might say about the movie, about you, and perhaps about humanity as a whole. Today we're talking about A Few Good Men, and Graham, my one question for you is, can you handle the truth?
You know, the truth might be a little bit uncomfortable to engage with, but I think my general hope as a human being is that I would be able to handle the truth, but I am super excited to be diving into this classic. This is my first time watching A Few Good Men, Kev.
I'm so curious. What did you think of it?
I thought it was awesome, which maybe I plug every movie at the beginning of the podcast by saying it was awesome, but this film specifically had absolute dynamite actors. I mean, first of all, Tom Cruise, fantastic. Demi Moore, 1990s Demi Moore, I think I have a crush on her. Jack Nicholson, incredible. Kiefer Sutherland, just people coming off the bench in this movie.
Kevin Bacon.
I mean, Kevin Bacon's like the fifth leading actor. Cuba Gooding Jr., who knew? So I think the acting was incredible. The writing was really great. I really do love Aaron Sorkin. I haven't seen West Wing, but I'm a big fan of his work. I think he did Social Network. Did he do Social Network?
Yeah.
Really great with the whole snippy dialogue and stuff. Not that I know that much about the technical side of movies, but I did really enjoy this film, and it was definitely worth watching.
So tell me a little bit about what you loved about the story, maybe apart from the more technical sides of acting and writing.
I really love the development of Caffey as a character. I think he goes from being very self-centered, kind of egotistical, to realizing that there are greater truths that he's willing to lay down his life for. I think Demi Moore's character is fantastic, an incredible supporter and advocate for the truth. But I also think that there's just great, clear wants that many of the characters have. I think, you know, Caffey wants to live up to his father's reputation. He wants to be perceived as a successful lawyer. He wants to be really good at his job. And then you've got people like Joanne Galloway, who really want to be perceived as being a successful lawyer, want to be taken seriously, especially in a room full of all men. And so I think a lot of the characters have very clear wants and very clear films in this movie, which makes for a lot of compelling tension. Kev, you're the one who initially suggested this movie. Why did you suggest A Few Good Men?
Yeah, lots of reasons. I think for one, it's a classic, and I think we wanted to be a little bit more varied in our genre on the podcast. We haven't done a courtroom, you know, drama, and we haven't really seen Tom Cruise, to my knowledge, and I think he is the premier actor of his generation, at least. It does invoke the military, which we haven't seen in any movie that we've done so far, I don't think.
What do you think makes this movie so endearing for many generations? I mean, it's very highly rated on IMDb. It's a very commonly referenced movie, one that a lot of people harken back to. What do you think has made it age well over time?
I think it's just well executed. I think it just follows great fundamentals of storytelling, great performances, great writing, great structure, a compelling plot line and series of subplots to accompany it. And I think we see in Star Wars, for example, like everyone is going to rush to the theater to see Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, because 7 came out and we want to know what happens next. But over time, I think like the movies that are done really well will continue to stay in the limelight, whereas those that had the initial rush of being a part of a larger story fade if they're not well told.
Yeah, I think it does a really good job at developing the relationship between Caffey and Joanne without even delving into the romantic storyline. Like, for me, watching the first time, I'm like, oh, the two of them are totally going to end up together at the end, and there's going to be this, like, climactic moment where he realizes that she completes him a la Jerry Maguire, which came out 4 years later. But there wasn't that, and yet there is still a compelling relationship developed between the two characters. I just think the movie does a good job at drawing us into Caffey's character and aligning our desires with his.
Yeah, in a weird way, this is just honest confession. Like, there's a part of me that doesn't feel like Jessup is all that guilty. There is a part of me that thinks, like, his real evil is in the way that he treats people like Caffey upon his visit to the base, more so than what he did with Private Santiago.
Yeah, I agree that his demonization is at least more so through the lens of his interactions with others than it is through what happened with Santiago in that situation, or the whole idea of having code red. And we see, you know, a couple other Marines brought to the witness stand testifying about their own experience with code reds. One of the Marines even kind of smiles and laughs a little bit, recounting his experience. So yes, we're led to believe that code reds are bad, but it's really Jessup who's worse than the code red itself.
You're sort of like drawn to root for him a little bit in the way that the other officers kind of want to get rid of the Santiago guy. And Jessup's like, no, like, we're not going to give up on him. Like, we're going to train him.
Right.
It feels very noble. And it feels like, oh, this guy's really committed to the code. And like, he's committed to like seeing the best version of these young men. And
yeah. And aren't the best villains usually the ones that are committed deeply to some sort of code? Even if it's a lack of a code, you know, I'm thinking about Thanos, deeply committed to his code. Joker, deeply committed to his lack of a code. And I think, again, villains who have very clear wants and expectations of themselves are often more compelling than people who just want to create chaos because, you know, they like chaos.
Agree. I think another sneaky thing this movie does, whether it's Sorkin or the director or both, I don't know, is when Caffey does visit and Jessup is sort of like, wait, Lionel Caffey was your dad? Like, oh my gosh, like, he was an incredible lawyer. Like, the school board told a little black girl she couldn't go to school there, and your father said, well, we'll just see about that. And so you sort of like start to root for the humanity of Jessup in that moment too, because he is like very approving of the father figure of the Caffey we know, who we're sort of told to like.
Right. Yeah, 100% agree. And then it's kind of a little bit of a downward spiral from there. Or maybe it's just the juxtaposition of those two personalities, one that respects the code and respects justice, and the other one that wants to enact his own policies because he kind of believes he's the god of that situation down there in Guantanamo Bay.
So should we get into some awards?
I think it's about time.
All right, why don't you kick things off with your Lazarus Award for the high-key gospel moment of A Few Good Men.
So my Lazarus Award is the classic "you can't handle the truth" scene.
Lieutenant Kendrick ordered the code red, didn't he? Because that's what you told Lieutenant Kendrick to do.
Object!
And when it went bad, you cut these guys loose!
Your Honor,
you had markets inside a bony transporter!
Your Honor, you doctored the logbook!
Damn it, Captain!
You coerced the doctor!
Consider yourself in contempt!
Colonel Jessup, did you order the code red?
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
And this is also my pulpit pick. So you can't handle the truth. This quote by Colonel Jessup, played by Jack Nicholson, is by far the most famous line from this movie. So in context with Jesus in the Bible, what is the truth that we quote-unquote can't handle? And I think there's a number of directions to go here, but I'm going to list out my top three. So number one truth that we can't handle based on the Bible, the truth of our own sinfulness. We're actually a lot worse than we think we are. The truth is that even our deepest self-examination of our own sinfulness fails to scratch the surface of our own rebellion against God. It is impossible to fully comprehend the depths of our own brokenness. That's Romans 6:23, for the wages of sin is death. But how deeply have we examined ourselves to see how deeply we do deserve death? And even if we go through the practice of confession and rooting out and recognizing all the evils in our life, David, the psalmist, often goes to God and says, search me, test me, and know my anxious thoughts. Like, look within me and discover the brokenness that I can't even discover within myself. And so number one, you can't handle the truth because if you fully knew it, it would absolutely break you. And so just like Jessup is responsible for the death of Santiago, we too are responsible for our own deaths and the large-scale death of this world because we're complicit in corporate sin, and the truth is almost an impossible burden to bear. Truth number two that is hard to handle, the truth of God's grace. Despite the unknowable depths of our rebellion against God, the even more uncomfortable and yet also beautiful truth is that God sees this rebellion and gives us Jesus to take our punishment. And we've got the classic line here, Romans 5:8, but God demonstrated his own love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And so think about that in the context of A Few Good Men. That would be like Caffey, who's the Jesus figure, I would say, in this scene, relentlessly pursuing the truth through getting Jessup, the colonel, to admit that he has ordered the code red. It would then look like Caffey volunteering to take Jessup's place for the ensuing punishment. So rather than playing the role of judge, jury, and executioner, Jesus plays the role of judge. We are the jury that unlawfully sentenced him to death, and he is the executed. And so we can't handle the truth of a love that is that selfless. Have we honestly looked at ourselves in the mirror and seen that Jesus is the one who died for us, and then also was willing to take our place for the very death that we deserved? So that's the second truth that is hard to handle. And three, the truth of our own redemption. Because of Jesus stepping in to take our place, we are given a new lease on life and get to live life with him as, quote, more than conquerors through him who loved us. This is Romans 8:37. We live out an identity of forgiveness, an absence of shame, and a charge to share the grace with everyone around us that we have discovered for ourselves. And so the third truth that we can't handle is that our lives are no longer our own. We no longer live for ourselves, we live for Christ. This changes our entire perspective, our entire focus, our day-to-day intentionality with people and relationships around us, and every day becomes an adventure and an opportunity to share the treasure that we have found in the redemptive friendship of Jesus. So, again, my Lazarus Award, you can't handle the truth. These are the three truths that I think are really hard to handle, but they are good truths and they are worthy truths worth discovering. And so that's why you can't handle the truth, even though Jessup is not my Jesus figure, wins my Lazarus Award for this specific line.
So interesting. So for you, that classic line resonates because you feel like you cannot handle the truth that God and the Bible bring.
Yeah, I think if we're really to look at it at its core, it is, again, the most terrifying news that we'll ever hear, but also the best news that we'll ever hear. And I don't think I will ever fully comprehend until I am with God face to face one day the depths of that truth.
So at the same time that you're saying you can't handle the truth, you are a professing Christian. Like, you've decided to follow Jesus with your life. So in some sense, you have handled the truth. Can you explain kind of how that transition happens, or sort of what makes you different from maybe old self in some ways?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between handling the truth and accepting the truth. I think I can, you know, at a basic surface level, accept the truth that I am a broken person and that I need somebody to save me. But one of the things that we've referenced over time on this podcast is that graph, and I wish we could have a visualizer for it, but it looks kind of like a greater than symbol, and there's a cross in between. And the top of the graph represents God's grace, and the bottom of the graph represents our sinfulness. And so as we initially have that threshold moment of coming to know Jesus and accepting him as our Savior, we have a recognition of our own sinfulness and of God's grace to bridge that gap. But I think as we continually grow in our relationships with the Lord and grow in our walks of faith, we understand a deeper depth of our own sinfulness and consequentially a greater depth of God's grace and his willingness to come and rescue us. And so I think we can handle the truth in the sense that we can accept the basic idea that we are in need of a Savior. But the more and more we plunge into the depths of our own sinfulness and recognize that, the more incomprehensible God's grace becomes. And so, yes, I think I understand that I am in need of help, but the vastness of that is almost too hard to grasp.
Yeah, I love that graph. I think it really articulates the subjective view. And I think of it as a less than symbol, but same idea, I guess. Like, in our minds, our holiness is getting worse and worse, and God's holiness is getting higher and higher. But, like, in reality, they're two parallel lines that have never once changed.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting contrast with, you know, we got John 3:30, which is, he must increase, I must decrease, which I think subjectively is true. But the reality is, like, God doesn't need to increase. Like, he is already big. Our recognition of who God is must increase, not the reality of that.
Yeah. Good comparison to that verse there.
All right, Kev, you ready for your Lazarus Award?
Yeah, so I agree that your moment is obviously the big one of the movie, but for whatever reason, for me, it's not that much Jesus-y vibes. When I really think about the gospel jumping off the page, so to speak, in this movie, for me, it's this little quote from Joe.
Why do you like them so much?
Because they stand on a wall and they say, nothing's gonna hurt you tonight. Not on my watch.
So I love the resolute passion that Joe has here, that even if she's not the best litigator, or like she's basically just kind of crapped to the bed in the previous scene in the courtroom with the doctor, Your Honor, I strenuously object. And so I think, to me, Joe just captures what Jesus does for us. Like, he is the ultimate watcher on the wall. And walls were like a really big deal in biblical times, right? Because they didn't have drones and aircraft, and like, it was just a very primal, like, this is our city, the water flows through here, and we build walls to keep out the enemies. And there were a lot of enemies. And so initially my mind was drawn to Nehemiah for this, like Nehemiah after the exile from Babylon, the deportation of Israel, he asks the Persian King Cyrus if he can go restore the walls of Jerusalem, this city that's being restored in the sort of Ezra, Nehemiah time of Israel's history. And Cyrus gives him permission, and he goes to build this great project and ends up completing the walls. And so here at the end of that, in chapter 7, we have these verses 1 through 4. Now when the wall had been built, and I had set up the doors and the gatekeepers, the singers and the Levites had been appointed, I gave my brother Hanani and Hananiah, the governor of the castle, charge over Jerusalem, for he was a more faithful and God-fearing man than many. And I said to them, let not the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is hot. And while they're still standing guard, let them shut and bar the doors. Appoint guards from among the inhabitants of Jerusalem, some at their guard posts and some in the front of their own homes. The city was wide and large, but the people within it were few, and no houses had been rebuilt. So it's not like a clear one-to-one here, but the idea is that, like, Jesus is like the true and greater Nehemiah, the true and greater like establisher of the kingdom's borders and protection. And I think we actually get a better glimpse of this in Psalm 121, and it's short, so I'm going to actually read the whole thing. And I love the imagery here of God as this guard on the wall that does not fall asleep, that he does his job. He says, nothing's going to hurt you tonight, not on my watch. Listen to this powerful imagery. I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. And so especially in that last verse, verse 8, like he'll keep you, you're going out and you're coming in, like very much nature, like imagery of like a door or a wall. And so I think this psalm really captures how Jesus is like the guard that doesn't fall asleep. Like, he is the true and greater Dawson and Downey, and he obeys his Father in doing so. And that one day in the kingdom of God, there won't be need for a walls, because all of God's enemies will have been brought to justice. Every knee will bow, every tongue will confess. There are those in heaven and there will be those in hell. And until then, it's Jesus standing on the wall saying, nothing's going to hurt you tonight, not on my watch.
I love that. I wonder if the watchful protector is kind of a dying trope in 21st century, because we all got our own security systems, and obviously there's a lot of tension always with, the role of the military and the role of the police department in modern days. And so this whole trope has kind of been maybe dismantled. But I think about it as being a really great movie trope. The person that immediately came to mind was Heimdall in Thor, the watchful protector, the one who sees everything that is affecting us and around us. And also, the tagline from The Dark Knight, the watchful protector, the silent guardian, the Dark Knight, the hero that sees everything that we don't see. Maybe it's a little bit obvious of a question, but why do you think that that trope is so appealing to us?
I think it's appealing because we don't feel protected. Like, we feel the great instability of life, and we really want to believe that there is a guard on the wall who has our backs and who's going to enable us to pursue the things that give us meaning and identity and purpose, and that we can do so without fear of a threat constantly. That was appealing 2,000 years ago in Israel's history, and it's appealing now. I think one of the reasons that trope might be declining is because we have different political opinions about the ethics of a wall, and like, we have a changed landscape ideologically about what it means to be inside a place and what it means to be outside. And there's a lot to be affirmed and critiqued, right? In a lot of ways, it's good that we're seeing more complexity, that we're being more maybe inclusive and trying to think about people and lives that are different from our own. But we have to recognize that there's a cost of that ideology, and maybe that trope is part of the cost.
Yeah, maybe it feels like the focus is more shifted to the danger inside our own walls.
Right. I mean, which could certainly be and often is more dangerous. And so, you know, I'm not taking any kind of opinion here. I'm just saying it makes sense to me that the decline of this Watcher on the Wall trope is happening. I also think of Game of Thrones. I think to me, there's no better example than Jon Snow. These knights of the wall take this oath, like, I am the Watcher on the Wall. I am the Sword in the Darkness. And it's considered like the most honorable position in that world of Westeros. It's like the men who sign up for the Night's Watch and, you know, are guarding the wall, protecting the rest of the kingdom.
I love that. Good stuff.
So move on to your Mary Magdalene Award for a low-key gospel moment in A Few Good Men.
So my Mary Magdalene Award goes to the line by Caffey that says, "It doesn't matter what I believe, it only matters what I can prove."
Do you believe they have a case? You and Dawson, you both live in the same dream world. It doesn't matter what I believe. It only matters what I can prove. So please, don't tell me what I know and don't know. I know the law.
So in this scene, Joanne is trying to convince Caffey to take the case to court, but Caffey refuses because he thinks he has no chance of winning. And even though he believes that Dawson and Downey did nothing wrong, justifying that before the jury is an entirely different animal. And so what we have here is a classic tension between faith and facts. And what immediately came to mind for me, and this may seem kind of random, is the famous 2014 debate between Ken Ham and Bill Nye at the Creation Museum. I don't know if you've ever watched any of this or read about it.
I'm familiar with Ken Ham and Answers in Genesis, but I'm honestly, I can't wait to see where you go with this.
So I don't know if you've heard of the Creation Museum. It's just outside of Cincinnati. It's actually in Kentucky. They built a life-size Noah's Ark there. They held a debate about creationism versus evolution, the clashes between science and the Bible and anthropology and all that kind of stuff. And it was a two-hour debate that didn't really change anybody's opinions. It just only further entrenched people in their own camps. Does that sound familiar to our current political landscape? And as a side note, I find this whole debate frustrating because I believe that God exists outside the confines of human logic and understanding on this deeper plane, and yet we're trying to use human logic and understanding to provide facts when Jesus explicitly calls for faith over proof. There's a line in Mark 8:12 where he says, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given to it." That's a conversation for another time. But really, I think Caffey's line here is actually anti-biblical. The line, "It doesn't matter what I believe, it only matters what I can prove." But the question is relevant for so many believers and skeptics alike. And how do we balance this juxtaposition between belief and proof? And for me, the conclusion I come to, and maybe this isn't right, and maybe you can push back on this, but it's the difference between theory and experience. And I believe that faith becomes facts when we take a chance to experience the life that Jesus has for us. And what I mean by that is stepping out in faith actually provides us an opportunity to experience firsthand God's grace and God's goodness and his sovereign control in the world. And there's so many different biblical examples of this. Here are a couple that came to mind. Peter trusting Jesus to walk on water, the disciples trusting Jesus to cast their nets and ultimately catching fish, Moses trusting the Lord to take the chance to part the Red Sea, Israelites trusting God by marching around Jericho. The list goes on and on and on. And so what Caffey says is that it doesn't matter what I believe, it only matters what I can prove. What if living into that belief, taking concrete actions on it, allows for us to be the living proof of who God says he is? And what I mean by that is throughout this movie, you get to see Caffey actually begin to live into that belief. There seems to be a contrast between beliefs and what he's able to prove. And really, he is able to prove that it wasn't Dawson and Downey's fault. But in order to prove it, he needs to live into his belief. And I think that's the very definition of faith, is living into our belief. And so by taking the steps of of subpoenaing Jessup and bringing him before the court and taking the chance to examine him and put his whole career on the line, that's ultimately what provides justice in this film. And so I think it does matter what we believe more so than what we can prove, because belief actually has the opportunity to lead to proof. Does that make sense to you? Do you have pushback on that?
I do think that there is a spectrum here to be recognized, as if one extreme is like we can't know anything and the other extreme is like we can know everything, there's certainly some tension and wrestling to be done here, because my mind, when you sort of were talking about the Bill Nye Ken Ham stuff went to Shylin, where he opens a lot of songs where he says, like, Lord, you gave us a mind, like, our minds, like, surely a major purpose was to think about you rightly when we praise and worship. That's, like, been a meaningful kind of motif in his music for me, is, like, I want to think about God rightly. But I also want to do so with the knowledge, like you said, that, like, at the end of the day, this is going to be by grace through faith. Like, I have to trust that there's a God that has cosmic intelligence far beyond mine, that has a plan for my life and deliverance for it. But at the same time, like, he has given us reason and he wants us to make real decisions, right? We see this all the way back with Adam and Eve in the garden. They don't have all the answers, and that's part of their frustration. That's part of why they eat the fruit. But they have enough answers to know that the fruit is bad, and to make an alternative decision. So there's such a tension here that is very challenging, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. And really, it's the idea of faith is beliefs that are tested, and in testing out his beliefs, like, Kaffee begins to live out in faith his belief, and in that experience the truth.
Yeah, and I think this is also part of why we have a verse like Romans 10:9, where it's like, confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead. Because what we see in the New Testament, when people encounter Jesus and believe in what he says, their lives are radically different.
Right.
And so that's why we kind of have this faith works tension throughout the Bible, because even though it is by faith and it's like purely a belief in the atonement on the cross, that the blood of Jesus will pay for sin, if we really do believe that this story is true, it is going to transform the way that we live. And so when our lives don't look transformed, we have to kind of maybe ask ourselves a tough question, or maybe someone in our lives will ask it for us. Do you actually believe this is true? Because right. if yep. it did, you would be different. And so it's just such a tough, it's very easy to conflate cause and effect.
Yeah. All right, Kev, what is your Mary Magdalene Award?
So I'm giving my Mary Magdalene Award to a small dialogue exchange that you actually referenced earlier, when Kaffee and Joe are at the lobster dinner. And I think we get this short little quip that really touches deeply on the human condition here.
Where I have earned 2 meritorious service medals and 2 letters of commendation.
Why are you always giving me your resume?
Because I want you to think I'm a good lawyer.
I do.
No, you don't.
And this is my pulpit pick. And so even though in some ways this little exchange is serving to set up Kaffee turning the scene by telling Joe, hey, you need to embrace the reality that we're probably going to lose, and we're going to lose huge, this is a really interesting character development moment, and I think it touches on ideas that we all feel pretty deeply. And so I actually mulled this over in my head for a long time, trying to figure out what was so compelling about it. And so at first I sort of thought, well, there's this idea of wanting to be elite at something, but never really achieving it, kind of unfulfilled dreams maybe. And that maybe that's kind of what Joe's feeling here. Like, I'm an okay lawyer, but like, he's an exceptional lawyer. And we get that kind of set up in the beginning scene where when she goes into the office, in short, sir, I'd like to request that it be I that handles this case. And she gets turned down. And she's kind of bummed that, like, they pick, you know, the young, arrogant Kaffee. She's like, oh, I wasn't really taken seriously. She feels like she could have done better. But I don't think that's quite what's going on here. I don't think that this moment is compelling purely or even primarily because of Joe's unfulfilled dream. So here's the next thing. Wanting to convince the someone who is elite that you're good enough. And I think that this is closer, but still not quite. I do think that Joe wants to convince Kaffee that she is a good lawyer, as she says, like, she wants him to think that. But I think there's actually something a little deeper going on here, and I think it's wanting the someone who is elite to actually convince you that you're good enough, like wanting the elite to prove that he or she likes you and finds you worthy. Because it's really Kaffee's opinion of Joe that matters seemingly more to Joe than her own opinion of herself. She doesn't want Kaffee to just say, yeah, I think you're good. Like, as we see in this scene, like, she wants him to convince her that she's good. Like, she doesn't believe herself that she's good, because she's come to realize he's exceptional. And if he were to actually believe that I'm really good, then and only then would I be really good. And maybe you're starting to see some of the gospel parallels here. Like, it's not like, obviously, as humans, we fail our own expectations for ourselves, not just morally, but in performative career parts of our lives too, like the lawyer parallel here. But in a lot of ways, like, we want God's approval even more than we want our own approval, because we know that the opinion of the holy, righteous creator God of the universe, that opinion matters more to ours. And I think we feel that. And so I want to bring up some clips here, though, because I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, the gap between who we want to be and who we are, the tragic realization that there's a huge gap there a lot of times. And I think the lie is that we can actually escape this. And we've talked before about different ways of doing that, determination, denial, despair. But I think the truth is that this gap is felt at all levels of all professions by all people. And so let's first take a look at a really, really old interview on 60 Minutes with Tom Brady, where he's basically like, yeah, I've got all these Super Bowl rings, but I still feel empty.
But with all that money, fame, and career accomplishments, we were surprised to hear this from him.
Why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey, man, this is what it is. I reached my goal, my dream, my life is me. I thank God. It's got to be more than this.
What's the answer?
I wish I knew.
So that's profound, but maybe you've heard that before, and maybe that even feels outdated. So let's talk about this other Shawn Johnson clip. Shawn Johnson, Olympic gymnast, gold medal winner, but really known more for being a silver medal winner. She won 3 out of 4 silvers at the 2008 Beijing Summer Olympics, but she was supposed to win all golds. Like, everyone was saying, like, she's going to get nothing but gold. And so listen to what she has to say about this experience in Beijing.
Every news article in the entire world said that I was going to come home with 4 Olympic gold medals. And I told everybody it was the biggest honor of my life, but really kind of crushed my heart. I remember being given the silver medal on the podium. The person who did it gave me a hug and told me, he said, I'm sorry. Being told I'm sorry, so it was kind of like a validation in my heart that I had failed. I got 2 more silver after that, then finally got a gold, but it was like once I got the gold, like, it didn't matter, but like, I felt like the damage was done. I felt like I had failed the world. I felt like since the world saw me as nothing else, then if I failed at being a gymnast, I failed at being a human being.
And so I think this last quote that you heard about how she feels like she lets down the world as a human being, just for how she let down the world in gymnastics, touches on something deep too, that this performative gap that a lot of times we feel in our careers or at school or whatever it is that we're sort of trying to achieve is quickly entangled, maybe even inseparably entangled with the moral gap, that like we feel this human letting down of ourselves and to God and to the world that's very, you know, tied up in our performative efforts. And so we give our resumes to others so that they'll think we're good enough. We give our resumes to ourselves to convince ourselves that we're good enough. We give our resumes to God, hoping that he'll think we're good enough, because we don't only want to be, you know, morally perfect or maybe just morally better. We also want to be valuable and esteemed and widely and well-liked and contributing to society and to the lives of those we know in a unique and essential way. Like, we want purpose and identity and meaning. But the reality is that God has actually bridged this gap for us between our unrighteousness and his righteousness. And when I think about giving resumes out in the Bible, my mind goes to Philippians 3. And this is Paul talking about how as a Jew, he had a, quote, great resume, but he threw it all away when this Jesus guy changed his life. And so this is Philippians 3, 4 through 9. Though I, Paul, myself have reasons for confidence in the flesh, meaning like in his life, like in his material world. If anyone else thinks he has reason for confidence in the flesh, I have more. Circumcised on the 8th day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as to the law, a Pharisee, as to zeal, a persecutor of the church, as to righteousness under the law, blameless. But whatever gain I had, I counted as loss for the sake of Christ. Indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake, I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish in order that I might gain Christ and be found in him, not not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ, the righteousness from God that depends on faith. And so we see that Paul's drawing his righteousness from a different place, a place that's outside of himself. Jesus' righteousness accomplished through the atonement on the cross and the perfect life that Jesus lived. And so, I just think this is a compelling idea. I want to be thoughtful in my life about any time and any place that I feel this need to give someone my resume, even if it's to myself.
Well, I appreciate your honesty and transparency there, and I think you're very much not alone in feeling that. I think my question would be, what are we supposed to do with resumes then, and this whole idea in our culture? Like, are resumes and the whole LinkedIn idea and proving ourselves, is it just a necessary evil for anybody who wants to accomplish anything significant in the secular world? Like, how are we supposed to balance that? Like, are we just supposed to not have resumes?
Yeah, I mean, good question, right? So a tough question. I think, as is the answer for most of these types of questions, we want to use scripture to affirm and critique. So let's just do a little bit of that right now. Like, what can we affirm about the importance of a resume and the importance of pursuing a career with genuine ambition?
Certainly there is something to be admired in using the gifts that God has given us to work hard and to be the best steward of that gift that we can be. I think when it becomes about personal glory and not about utilizing the gifts that we have received, that kind of puts us in a dangerous place.
Yeah, I think that's a good start. I would go beyond admired. I would say it's obedient to steward the gifts. I think about a friend of mine who's elite at what he does, and he talks about the parable of the talents, how these different guys were given one talent, five talent, 10 talents of gold while their master went on a journey, and they're entrusted with stewarding that wealth and growing it. And so no matter how many talents we've been given, we want to steward it well, and we want to bring glory to the kingdom. Think about the Westminster catechisms, the purpose of man, you know, to glorify God and enjoy him forever. The first part, glorifying God, and really the second part too, they shouldn't be mutually exclusive, but we want to glorify God with our time and our talents. And so, yeah, I would say it's more than just admiration. But yeah, like you said, when it becomes about us, or when we start to think that God needs us to do these things, even if that thing is ministry, perhaps especially when that profession is ministry, it can be a really dangerous place to be. And yeah, to come full circle, I love how Sean Johnson closes out this interview, and we sort of see where Sean and Tom Brady's storylines kind of started in a similar place on this topic. They ended very different places. Listen to what she says here.
All for that gold medal again, that I distinctly remember in 2008 not being the greatest thing in the world. And I think it's just kind of that validation that there's always more. God is the answer to everything. And Jesus sacrificed his life on the cross so that when I stood up there and I was given that gold medal, yes, it's a monumental and amazing experience and wonderful thing, but it's not the end all be all. Yes, I can work my whole life to become the CEO of a company or to make a certain amount of money or to win 12 more Olympic gold medals, but it's not the purpose in life. And he will always be my greatest reward and my proudest reward.
So yeah, there are stories of ways that people who are elite at their professions in this world have Christ at the center of it. And I think that it's tough because at those very, very high levels, it becomes increasingly hard to critique, why am I doing this? How am I doing this? Because you can imagine.
That's good stuff, and definitely some food for thought for us as we are considering what it looks like to do that in our own lives.
Yeah, it's an entrance to a broader conversation, so email us if you'd like to continue that at jesusandmovies@gmail.com. In the meantime, be thoughtful about who is it in your life that you are feeling the need to give your resume to and why. What is it about that approval or that affirmation that is so enchanting to you, and what does that say about what you want and who you care about? And yeah, I think we just, more than anything else, we just want to be thoughtful about these things. We want to be introspective in our prayer. So take me to your false prophet award for a non-biblical argument a few good men makes.
So my false prophet award goes to the idea that the ends justify the means. So this is something that Jessup is definitely critiqued for throughout the film. the idea that calling in a code red is ultimately going to protect the unit. That seems to be his ideology, that in kind of bullying one of the lower members of the Marines, that it actually is best for everybody else. But doesn't Caffey actually do that same thing to Jessup, especially in that moment where he's on the stand? And we've got this interesting contrast that maybe we can have a conversation about between mastering the craft of being really good at your job, in Caffey's case, is being a really good examining lawyer, versus being somebody who manipulates other people for their own gain. And so maybe, you know, this is something to open up to a broader conversation, but when Caffey puts Jessup on the stand, is he really baiting him to say the things that Caffey wants him to say, or is he extracting the truth that's already been there? I would argue that in this movie, Caffey is manipulating Jessup, not extracting the truth in a graceful way, but extracting the truth through having him fall into certain potholes that he otherwise wouldn't have. And so for us, as we do ministry, like, are we having genuine conversations where we're actually searching for the truth and asking caring questions about what the other individual believes the truth to be? Or are we kind of placing our little landmines so that people will fall into the right potholes and be forced to ask the right questions? And is there anything wrong with that? And so the verse I want to reference here is 1 Samuel 16:7. But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." And so even though something might be perceived as extracting justice, like, the Lord's going to look at our heart and say, are we doing that because we care about justice, or are we manipulating the other person in order to make ourselves seem more just and look good? So you have any thoughts on that?
I like the inconsistency that you've pointed out, at the very least, between the ends justify means being kind of a great sin of Jessup and the great villain of the movie, and yet we're strangely comfortable when Caffey sort of does similarly questionable practices in law, right? Like getting the O'Malley, Ehrman, Cecilman and O'Malley or whatever. And like, but he does come truthful with Jack and sort of says, like, yeah, they were going to testify that they have no recollection. So maybe this is fair play. I'd love to talk to an elite Christian lawyer. Like, I think there are some reasons why lawyers are stereotyped as they are, because there are these really demanding ethical situations where it's hard to know what the right thing to do would be. I love what Jack says earlier at the bar scene. Like, I represent the government of the United States without passion or prejudice. I don't get to make that call. My client has a case. Like, he is putting aside his own desires and doing what he thinks his client is right. And when a lawyer agrees to do that, it opens up a lot of tricky questions about how, to what extent and how do you go about doing that? How important is it to win? What are you willing to do to get there? I just don't have the answers. Like, I find myself just as curious about it as you are.
I'm sure. And there's a lot of nuance and a ton of biblical nuance, especially in the Old Testament, when David's like, "Do I not hate those who hate you, God?" And essentially is praying on his enemy's downfall. But what are we supposed to do, you know, with that? And are we supposed to view the legal system as similarly righteous as the way in which we view God's law? Like, that's a good nuanced conversation to be having.
Yeah, it's tricky. And it kind of leads naturally into my false prophet award, which is pride in our justice bringing.
All you did was weaken a country today, Caffey. That's all you did. You put people's lives in danger. Sweet dreams, son.
Don't call me son. I'm a lawyer and an officer in the United States Navy. And you're under arrest, you son of a bitch.
So I think we should affirm that the movie argues for principle, for doing what's right no matter the circumstances. But, you know, because that's very much upheld as like the good here. Like, even though Jessup has done all these incredible things and defended the nation so well, he's done so in ways that on principle are flawed and illegal even at points. And so I think I want to critique that the movie argues that we are better people for choosing the right side of things, like that we're able to leverage moral high ground over those who choose differently from us. That's kind of the big idea here. So I've got Romans 3 verses 23 to 27. "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. It was to show his righteousness at the present time, so that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. Then what becomes of our boasting? It is excluded. By what kind of law? By a law of works? No, but by the law of faith. What has become, like, what becomes of our boasting? Like, on what grounds does Kaffi have to see himself as so much morally better than Jessup? You know, biblically speaking, none are righteous, no, not one. The righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. By works, none are any better than others. And not to argue that the movie has this huge moral divide between Jessup and everybody else, but I think we do kind of feel like, yes, our boy Kaffi did it. Like, we're on the right side. Jessup is on the wrong side. And the reality, like you pointed out, is that there's plenty of moral gray on the quote good side here, and that we really have no right to judge those who choose differently from us on these matters.
Yeah, and especially there's the reality that Kaffi and his crew are very much detached from the situation that's going on down in Guantanamo, and they don't face the direct risks that the squad of Marines faces. And so it's easy to kind of, again, the whole classic argument that it's easy to sit up on Capitol Hill and make decisions about war when you're not the ones who are actually going to fight on the front lines. Like, there's definitely some of that going on as well.
Yeah, it's like, this is what we talked about at the beginning. Like, I find myself rooting for Jessup in a lot of ways. If he wasn't such a tool to everybody in the movie, like, I think he'd actually be an extremely likable character. Mm-hmm. Take me to your Jesus Award for some redemption here for a Christ-like character in this film.
My Jesus Award goes to Joanne in Easily.
Easily?
Easily, yes. I think Joanne is an incredibly Christ-like character in this film, and I'm going to list out what she does. She has a relentless belief that Dawson and Downey are worth defending. She's willing to take an impossible case because the truth she believes is worth fighting for. She's willing to challenge Kaffi to fight even when he's not willing to. She speaks truth into his competency as a lawyer and as a friend in a time of crisis. She's publicly scorned because she doesn't belong in the company of these military men. I'm thinking of the lunch scene in Cuba where Jessup openly insults her in front of the other men. So like Jesus, she's publicly scorned. She reminds Jessup that he actually cares more than he openly admits. This is when they have the conversation about the transfer order. Why did Kaffi seek the transfer order when he didn't actually need it from Jessup? She cares to know Aunt Jenny, who's Downey's only living family, and in caring to know her and build a relationship, she actually wins an advantage in the trial.
You got permission from Aunt Jenny?
We got permission from Aunt Jenny. Can you believe it? That engaging the outcast might actually benefit your trial. And so she's also willing to risk her reputation as a lawyer alongside Kaffi to fight for justice. And so for me, it's very much of one of those horizontal gospel parallels of, hey, this is Jesus showing up for us and wanting what's best for us and loving us enough to not let us stay in our own shame and brokenness and egocentrism. And so the two verses that came to mind, Psalm 82:3, give justice to the weak and the fatherless, maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Again, Joanne advocating for the fatherless, like Downey is literally fatherless and she is fighting for him. And Isaiah 1:17, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, bring justice to the fatherless, and plead the widow's cause. And so I think Joanne does a lot of that throughout this film. She really fights for what is righteous and what is good, and that's why she wins my Jesus Award.
I love it. Make a great case for the more empathetic side of Jesus, the Hermione side of Jesus, if you will, the horizontal.
Oh, baby.
I'm going a little bit more vertical, a little bit more of the divine side of Jesus, because I've picked Kaffi. I didn't mean to like interrupt there. We can maybe sort of hash out each character afterwards. So here's my reasons for picking Kaffi. I think he's the most talented. And anytime I see a character that's really good at anything, besides wanting to root for them, I'm also sort of relating them to Jesus because Jesus is, you know, perfect. So we have Mark 1:22 here. And they were astonished at Jesus' teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. We see similar sentiments echoed in Matthew 7, 28 to 29, and really throughout the Gospels. Like, people are really surprised with the authority and the truthfulness of Jesus' teaching. It's totally new to them. They're astonished. So he's really, really good. And then we have pleasing and imaging. I'll repeat that. Pleasing and imaging his distant father. And so in this case, Caffey is motivated by his father, Lionel Caffey, who was the greatest trial lawyer ever, as Sam says. And for this, we have John 14, 1 through 7, the beginning of the Upper Room Discourse, where Jesus is sort of talking about how he and his father are one, and he's going to a place where these disciples will one day be, but they don't know it for now. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. So kind of that father-son distinction there. Verse 2, in my father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would not have told you that I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. And you know the way to where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would know my Father also. From now on, you do know him and you have seen him. Implied there, like, because you've seen me. And so we have this great, like, the Son is obeying the Father. And this is just the introduction to what will be several chapters long of Jesus explaining and elaborating on these concepts. But this is what we see with Caffey in the movie, right? Like, he's constantly in this sort of question of how can I please my father? Like, what would my dad do here? Do you think my dad would have had Jessup take the stand? But we also see Caffey imaging his father. We see Sam saying, you know, if I had a choice between your father and you, like, you remind me so much of him, and yet I would still take you 7 days of the week and twice on Sunday or whatever it is. And so we see this kind of parallel with the father. Next, leading his disciples. Caffey seems like a pretty, like, individualistic shark that just kind of does his thing at the start of the movie. Like, he's the most successful lawyer in their office, and we kind of see him, like, develop his kind of team here of Sam and Joe. And we kind of see that with Jesus and the disciples. Like, what, you know, Jesus doesn't need the disciples, but he decides to turn these guys into fishers of men. This is Matthew 4, 18 and 19. While walking by the Sea of Galilee, Jesus saw two brothers, Simon, who's called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net in the sea, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. And so these guys are going to go follow him. We see the same thing. This is only a few verses later. This is verse 23. So that was 19 and 20. I'm skipping over two verses to get to this. And Jesus went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame, Jesus's fame, spread throughout all Syria. And they brought him all the sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, those having seizures and paralytics, and he healed them. And great crowds followed Jesus from Galilee and the Decapolis and from Jerusalem and Judea and from beyond the Jordan. And so Jesus gets famous because he's so good at what he does, and he's just, no one has ever seen anything or anyone like this before. We kind of see that with Caffey. Like, he's famous with his office. He has this electrically charismatic presence, right? Like, everybody is just feeling like, especially Joe, like, you're so good at this. Like, we need you to stand up and fight for this. Like, why can't you prove their innocence? Like, they don't need a good lawyer. They need a great lawyer. They need you. Like, only you can do this. And we sort of get this sense of, like, Caffey's, like, bringing these disciples under his vision. Like, all I have is, you know, Yoo-hoo and Cocoa Puffs, so bring your own food. We're going to work out of my house every night. And he's, like, bringing about, like, better litigators in Sam and Joe than they would be on their own. Like, he is sharing his expertise with them. And so it's very cool to see him kind of teaching as maybe Jesus taught, you know, Peter and John. And then lastly, and probably most importantly, a full send to enact justice. Caffey throws his life away for this case, right? Like, if he badgers the witness of Colonel Jessup, like, it's, as Jack says, like, staple to every job interview for the rest of your life. Like, you could get in a ton of trouble. Even Joe, who's been the idealistic character the whole movie, saying, go for it, go for it, go for it. Even she, right before he walks into the courtroom, says, hey, if you don't think you can get him, maybe don't go for it. Like, this will ruin your career. I know for a fact, professionally, I handle this stuff. Like, you will be screwed, basically. Like, your life is over. And we see Caffey, like, shaky hands chug that glass of water before he decides to send it. And you just have to feel like that's a little bit of a Garden of Gethsemane moment there for Jesus. Like, the shaky hand chugging of the water at the defense table before he decides to go after Jessup. So it's a full send to enact justice. He throws his life away. Mark 8:35. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it.
Mm.
Just as Jesus kind of cast away his glory to come down to earth. In a lot of ways, Caffey casts away the set of steak knives that he would have earned had he not taken this really challenging case and risked his entire career and reputation and everything. And so I think that's part of what makes this movie so good, too, is it feels like the stakes are so high. Like, this is a full send. This is everything. This is do or die. And so Caffey, like Jesus, risks it all. So in summary, he's the most talented. He's pleasing and imaging his distant father. He's leading his disciples, and he's full send to enact justice.
Yeah, I think a really clear and compelling argument there. I think there's so much to be affirmed. I would say for me, the reason that Caffey doesn't win it relative to Joanne is that he has kind of a gradual progression. I think he's a very different character at the end of the movie than he is at the beginning. Whereas to me, Joanne's a lot more steady.
Agree.
Again, I think there's still so much to be affirmed in the fact that he's willing to risk it all to bring about justice. And I think the cool thing about Jesus is that he is the stable character that doesn't go through any character change. Like, he is a gradual progression towards sacrifice without even really needing the encouragement of others. And yes, there's the kind of denial scene, or the, I guess, asking the cup to be taken for him scene in the Garden of Gethsemane. But again, like Jessup, and like Caffey, he continues forward with it and is willing to lay down his life. So yeah, a lot to be affirmed there.
Yeah, maybe it's a little bit like P.T. Barnum in The Greatest Showman, like higher highs but lower lows, and maybe Joe's a little bit more the flat line in the middle.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So that's it for the awards, and now onto the Q&A. But first, an announcement. Need new running shoes? Want to support a local business? Omega Sports sells running shoes and a variety of athletic apparel and equipment both in stores and online at omegasports.com. For online orders of at least $90, they offer free shipping everywhere, and use the redemption code JIM for Jesus and Movies. Doing so gives you 10% off your purchase and gives another 10% towards our production costs. Again, that's omegasports.com, code JIM for a discount and to support us. Now on to our Q&A and guest submission. Okay, so this week we have an awesome treat. We have Helen Webster, and Helen, you and Graham actually met on Bumble.
Yeah, we did.
How'd the date go?
This is our first date, actually, on Zoom.
None of this is true. Helen is a good friend from Davidson. She's a podcast expert. You want to tell us a little bit about your extracurricular interests?
Sure, Kevin. Thanks for having me. I'm super pumped. Yeah, I just listen to podcasts for fun, like, definitely a hobby at this point. I listen to a couple a day. I actually love Tim Keller's podcast, Gospel and Life. I try to listen to that in the mornings. Then as I get into work, maybe like a news podcast, if I'm feeling that. I listen to a lot of dating podcasts, which is how I found Graham. And then like some like hidden brain Freakonomics, like why we do what we do kind of thing.
So Helen, what's one way that God has revealed himself or the gospel or truth to you in something you've read or watched or listened to lately?
God has revealed himself to me in the show Billions I've been watching recently. It's a Showtime show. And he's revealed himself to me in a number of different ways, but I'll talk about two. So Billions is like a classic good versus evil story, which I know we love here at Jim. Basically, there's like this hedge fund CEO and billionaire named Bobby Axelrod. And he's like, he owns Axe Capital, his hedge fund. Very successful, money-oriented, like pretty arrogant. And he sometimes does illegal things to make his money, like insider trading. And then Chuck Rhodes is the U.S. attorney in New York, and he like goes after Axe for these shady dealings. And then also like in Billions, like the guys who work at Axe and like the women, their overall like attitudes and everything about them is completely based on like how they do like trading that day. They like kind of lose it if they don't do well, and like they're so obsessed with their numbers. It's all they care about. They constantly have the TVs on, like looking at numbers and stocks and stuff, and their whole identity is in it. And so there are like clear messages in the Bible about idols and specifically money, and like Hebrews 13:5, keep your life free from love of money and be content with what you have, for he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Matthew 19:21, Jesus answered, if you want to be perfect, go sell your possessions, give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, then come follow me. And even Chuck, like he like turns down this big law job with really good financial benefits to stay like in his current role as attorney general. And he like really cares about being like just, he tells his team to like not waver in like what you're doing. So like, it's even hard for him. He wants to send his son to the same private school that he and his dad went to. And that's like really important to him. and that's not something that he's going to give up. And so like that extra money would really help him. So like, this is a pretty clear in Billions that like people care a lot about money, and the Bible says you shouldn't, but I just thought it was important too, because it seems like a very like main and plain message of the Bible, but it's like not necessarily that easy. It's like something's offered to you, like a lot of money is offered to you, it's hard to turn down. And that brings me to another point about Axe. Like, he's a really interesting character. Okay, I've also only seen season one. So like, someone could disagree with this if they've seen more. Like, I don't think he's that bad of a person. Like, he really cares a lot about money, but it's clear it's because he grew up without a lot of money, and same with his wife. And so he cares about it that much more because he knows what it's like to not have it. He like cares about justice. Like, he, this guy like drives his kids home drunk once, and he like runs to the guy's house and like beats him up because he's like, don't ever do that again. And that's like clearly not biblical and like not what he should do, but he seems to like care about righting wrongs. And like with his money, he's tried to do good, tried to like help these kids whose parents died in 9/11. But like, he's not a good person. But I guess my point here is also like, this applies to both Axe and Chuck, because Chuck is like super, has like strong morals and like believes in justice, but both of them like don't live God-centered lives. Like, even if Chuck has these like strong morals and does good things, like if he's not a Christian and it's not God-centered, then it doesn't really like mean much, I guess. Like, so like, it's kind of like a message to us that like, basically if you have these like good and moral attempts, like these acts that like aren't, you're not going to like get any closer to God through that. And our only way to like minimize the space between us and God is like through Jesus and our fellowship with Jesus. And then Colossians 2:6, just to like support this, then just as you receive Jesus Christ as Lord, continue to live your lives in him, and just like growing your fellowship with Jesus, and not just like, and like, that's what's important, your faith in him and not your works. Even like for someone like Chuck, who's like moral and doing quote unquote good things.
Oh, thanks for sharing. I really appreciate that analogy. And I understand you coming from money, valuing it more, there seems to be kind of a tie there. So maybe from a biblical perspective, or maybe if the show was to argue like, hey, there's a right way to handle this, like, how do we balance that of caring about money and its value that it has to us without allowing it to be an idol? Is there a middle ground to be found there?
Yeah. It is tough. Like, I think it's tougher than I like originally, when I was first thinking about it, I was like, this is pretty obvious. But like, it is, like if you're in a field, especially that's like presents you with like these opportunities to make a lot of money, especially like money, like really does like change things. Like, you can afford education and healthcare and like have the ability to help more people or tithe or whatever. So yeah.
Well, I think that wraps up, our conversation, but Helen, thank you so much for joining us on Jesus in Movies.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored.
So sadly, we've got to stop the discussion there. But before we close, here's a quick shout out to all of our supporters on Patreon who make this discussion possible. Courtney, Kristen Craig, Heather and Jackson Carlock, Tanner Carlson, Jacob DeRizio, Ben Dunbar, Graham, Janet and Ken Hooten, Daniel Lee, Bess McLawhorn, Mike, John Pabone, Scott Pahacek, Logan Russell, Andy Simmons, Kim Stramer, and Clay Young. Thank you all so much for your support. Our monthly production schedule is posted on our Instagram, at Jesus and Movies. And if you'd like to support the Jesus and Movies podcast, Patreon is our preference. For $1 a month, you can become a patron and pick the movies, get shouted out on the podcast, and featured on our Instagram. So if you'd like to join the group, please do so at patreon.com/Jesus and Movies or on the free Patreon app. Anyone can always write us at jesusandmovies@gmail.com. And if you're listening on Apple, please give us a review and let us know what you think. That helps us to learn more about what's working and what isn't, as well as to reach new people. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jesus Movies podcast, and we hope you found some goodness, truth, and beauty. Know that even though we couldn't handle the truth of our own depravity, Jesus guards the wall and gave his life to bring justice and redemption. And we'll see you next week.